Alice, great to be here again, and good to see all who have been able to stay over, as well as the local believers. And we trust that the Lord will grant his blessing this afternoon. I know that an afternoon meeting has its own special difficulties, Lord's Day afternoon, and they have a great number of these meetings in Scotland, and I've often heard the brethren there remind their hearers on such occasions that the disease of Sunday afternoon meago is very prevalent, and I don't want anyone to be unduly afflicted with it, so I hope you'll all be preserved from that particular disease. It means my eyes all glaze over. So if I see anyone being unduly afflicted, I'll call out as many names as I know. Actually, I slept in this hall once myself, but it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was no one else here. We had two forms put seat to seat, and the brethren put a sleeping bag up, and of course the back kept me from rolling off. They must have thought I needed a kind of a cot. And everything went well until I heard a noise, and I listened, and I heard more noise, and I could hear footsteps out there, and neither a man or angel or demon to help me. And then I heard a clear rattle at the door. It's a very vivid memory to me, I can assure you. And I remember peeping out through this window to discover it was a donkey. I'd come along at night, so that must be over 20 years ago or thereabouts, I'm not sure. And at that time we were painting the hall, and I painted this part. So I have a very forgiving spirit. I have come back. Well, the book of Daniel again in chapter 3. The book of Daniel in chapter 3. Verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 80 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then these 8 fellows all gathered together. Verse 4, then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up, and whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of these instruments, they worshipped. And of course, the verse 8, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. Now, they brought them before the king. Verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now, if ye be ready at what time ye hear the sound of these instruments, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made well. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, Be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. And then he became red hot, and then they heated the furnace. The men were cast in bound in verse 21. Now, I want to go to verse 25. He answered and said, Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. And they come out, verse 27, and the princes, governors, and captains of the king's counselors being gathered together, saw these men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was a hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. Then the king promoted the three individuals. Now that's as much as I want to read this afternoon from the Word of God, and again I'll try and say what I have to say, and then we can disperse, for the other meeting comes quite quickly. There have been two words that are rummaging around in my mind. I cannot really just at the minute account for these two words and why they appear the same, but that is the case. The words that I have in mind is the word forge or forgery. Now, we are living in a world of forgery. You know what it is to go to the blacksmiths, or at least you've read about it or heard about it or seen it. And he takes his piece of metal and he puts it into the fire until it's red hot, and then he comes down upon it with those fisty hammer blows. The metal cools a bit. He knows when to stop thumping. He puts it in again, heats it up, pedals the bellows with his foot, brings it out, does another piece of careful, calculated hammering, brings the pressure to bear in different places, in different points, at different angles. And when the process is over, that process is called forging. Now that forging, the blacksmith forging, cannot be done without a furnace. There is no other way in which he can shape the metal that it might become configured to the pattern that's in his mind. No way other than the furnace. The blacksmith forge is quite an art. Men unskilled in the art would not be able to really do anything. I could watch it, but I couldn't perform it. It seems when the man comes down with a hammer that he just wields the hammer and lets the hammer and the blows fly everywhere, and sparks and smites. Just no, but he knows exactly where he's hitting. And that's forgery. That's the forgery of the blacksmith. But then, this other word that has been also in my mind is the forgery of blackmail. Why do they call a counterfeit banknote a forgery? It hasn't been through the fire. It's just a makeshift. It couldn't even face the fire. It's just a deceitful copy. It's not the real thing at all. And I say again, how those two words are related. One word indicates what is so real and so strong and so good and so true. The blacksmith's forgery produces true metal. The other word describes what is so deceitful and so sham and so bad. But they're both forgery. Now, of course, we're living in a world of forgery. And both senses are true. The devil is busy at this forgery. Sham. Show. Superficiality. Nothing to it. The society in which we live is absolutely full of it. That's the devil's forgery. But you know, God is busy at this other kind of forgery. He's producing articles of quality. And he's taking some of the Christians of the best material. And so to speak, he puts his foot upon the bellows of circumstances. And he allows some of those saints to go into the furnace, the trial of life. And he wants to forge them so that they will be in the shape of his pleasure. Well, I think we not only have it in the world in which we live, but we have it in the world in which these three men lived. Because I take it that's part of the whole business of Daniel chapter 3. We have men facing the fire. Men who were absolutely pure. The genuine article. And I suppose it also took a fire to produce the big image. It likely took a fire as well. But it was some piece of Nebuchadnezzar manufacture, I tell you. But this other furnace, it contained men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that were really genuine. Now, as you think about this forgery, I hope that God will help us all as his children, that he will help us to be real and to be genuine in amidst a world of great, great counterfeit and all reality. What I'm talking about for about half an hour this afternoon is the forging of a real faith in a world that is most unreal. That's the truth of Daniel chapter 3. Now, I'll try and divide what I want to say into the following four little sections. I want to spend a little while speaking about the image which these men refuse. Then I want to think about the interview which these men had to face. And mind you, it was some interview with the big boss himself, Nebuchadnezzar himself. Then I want to think about the incinerator into which these men were cast. And having passed through the furnace and come out unscathed, I want to think about the influence which these three men exerted over the whole Babylonish empire. Really amazing. When this whole thing was over, there wouldn't have been a house in that whole empire where the name of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego wasn't known. But without the furnace, their names might not have been as well known. The trial meant that these became not only men of integrity, but men of amazing influence. Now, let me just go through that very, very quickly, or quite quickly again. Here we have got this great big image. It was, as I've already said, it was quite a masterpiece. We're told about the material of it. Gold. I don't think it was solid gold. If it had been solid gold, it would have taken tons of gold to make it. And gold wasn't that scarce about Babylon, but it would nearly have taken all the gold of all the world to make this great image. I think it was probably wood, but nice shiny stuff on the outside. Veneer. About 90 feet tall. And maybe nearly 20 feet wide. Maybe standing up on a big pedestal. On the plain of Jura. Nothing to block the view. Everything carefully landscaped. When the sun would shine upon this golden image, everything would be absolutely dazzling. You believe me, it absolutely looked the part. If you weren't a person that was inclined to idolatry, this would nearly have caught you. This wasn't a matter of like an Indian or a Hindu bowing down to a wee 6-inch image painted in 3 or 4 colors in a corner cabinet. And anybody knows, actually, that this was absolutely impressive. You see, there must be something to this. And of course, if you're going to make the thing impressive, not only will you need to have image, but you're going to need to have a great big crowd. So he gathers the whole bunch of them. The financial men, the legal men, the political men, the military men, and he gets them all, and peoples of all nations and languages, and they all crowd and cram into the plain of Jura. So you say, not only is this something that is like a skyscraper, it goes high, but it has a very, very wide appeal. The most of the people seem to subscribe. So you say, now, if I'm not going to subscribe, I'm going to look out of it a bit. Because there's a big crowd here. You see, I think Nebuchadnezzar had graduated from Trinity with a degree in psychology. Or maybe not just Trinity, but Harvard or somewhere, wherever it was. He knew how to... Well then, you get this thing all shining, and it appeals to the eye. And you have a massive big crowd. You talk about peer pressure. But he says we need to do a wee bit of... get a nice bit of music. Doesn't matter, you can play the bagpipes, or you can play the flute, the Irish flute, or you can play whatever you like. The cornet and the sackbut and the dulcimer and every instrument under the sky, it was all there. And they played lovely music. So that what was visible and what was audible and what was international. Nebuchadnezzar said, now listen, gentlemen, he said, I have a system established here, and he said, I don't only want you men to work in my system. He said, that's what you're doing. You're sheriffs and you're counselors and you're judges and you're this, that, and the other. He says, you're all working for me, and I'm keeping you. He said, I'm giving you your bread and butter. You're giving me your service and you're giving me your labor. But he said, really now, gentlemen, I'm not satisfied. I don't only want you to work for me. He says, I want you to worship me. He says, quite a system. It is quite a system. The unfortunate thing is that the system is still with us. It hasn't changed. Actually, I was telling them here somewhere recently that the editor of Vogue magazine, one of my favorite publications, as you would know, Freeland, she said, the only thing that counts is image. She said, I don't be concerned about the facts. She said, to sell my magazine, all I want is image. Whether it's really true or not, peel off the gold and tap the wood. I better not hit that too hard. And tap the wood, and you'll see that it's not as good and it's not as genuine. This is not solid. No, but get the gold on it. Get the gold on it. Make it look well. Make it impressive. Image. Of course, God is concerned with image as well. Only it's His image. His image. He said, I'm concerned about image. God has given us an image. That image, of course, is His Son. And He says, I want you to worship me. But the devil has a great big system. And the world system in which we live, it's... I don't want to talk too much about it, but you know, brethren and sisters, we have to face the facts. You know, it's all right when you're at this preaching business. You have a fairly cushy time. Like, it's a great thing sitting, reading the gospel hymn book and songs of victory all day, and then when you get tired, you lift down some of J.N. Darby's synopsis or something, just to pass in the time. I know that that's a great cushy life, but some of you, dear brethren, you're where the rubber hits the road, and you're at the cold face of industry, and you're every tomorrow morning, as sure as the alarm clock hits 7:30, you'll be sitting or standing 8 o'clock right in the system. And I want to tell you, that system doesn't only want your work. That system wants your very worship. And if that system can really get as much of you as it wants to have, there'll not be as much left for God as sits on the top of my first finger. Now, that system, of course, is greatly governed by, well, a number of things. First of all, it's governed by the principle of materialism. That's why we have all these details given to us right at the start of verse 1. The principle of the model of this great big image. I think it was the model of a man. Actually, I think it was the model of Nebuchadnezzar himself. And he said to himself, he said, you know, the people think I'm a big fella, but he says, I want them to think I'm even bigger. He says, I'm going to make an image of me 90 feet tall. He says, I'll be a big fella. Really? Bigger than I am? Image. What was I? Well, he might have been 6 feet, 1.5 or something. He might have been. And of course, well, if this image was, it was 60 cubits high and it was 6 cubits broad, it was quite stocky. You know, if I don't know what his breadth was, but, well, he said, if I can't, he says, I'm, just give a good impression, I'm real big. I'm the big fella here. And he says, it's material, it's gold and it's wood, it's model and it's measurement and it's material. And we're in a world, brothers and sisters, and I'm speaking again to those that have to face the world. You know, the whole thing is based and activated on the principle of materialism. What is just matter. That's why it's called the secular world. Like you take everything has changed. Moved away from spiritual things. What are the biggest buildings now? Now, I'm not recommending. You know me that I think they were misguided. But you know, 300 years ago, the biggest buildings in any city were the spires. And the people thought they were getting to heaven by building big spires, because this is very important. This is for God. This is God's house. It's not God's house at all. We know that. We know that from New Testament teaching. But they thought this is God's house, and this is the most important building in town. And when you're 4 miles outside in the country, or even London or any of those big cities, when you're miles away, you'll see the skyline dotted with spires that reach away up toward heaven. And the people said, the things of God, the house of God is the biggest business about here, and we put our best into it. What are the biggest buildings now? You know, if you look, go to London just. Christopher Wren, St. Paul's Cathedral, that used to dominate the whole place, is like a dwarf. And away up here, you can look down on Christopher Wren's Cathedral, just like a little speck from the top of the bank building. And high-rise office blocks. I don't get into politics because I would only get into trouble. And I'm interested in politics, actually. Not party politics. I'm interested in the politics of the Bible. And I believe that the collapse of the Twin Towers is a tragedy of the dear people that lost their lives in that. But I think God was teaching the world a lesson. Because those two towers stood as a symbol of man's prestige and pride. Materialism. And they call it ground zero. I tell you, God will bring this world back to ground zero before very long. But materialism. You take art. Go back, what will they say, 400 years. See all those great artists. I know you have one or two of them in the back room that you didn't let me see. Van Gogh and all that stuff. Rembrandt and all that. It's amazing the number of those artists and some of the greatest paintings. I was a bit of idolatry. I know that too in a sense. Some of the greatest paintings are paintings of scenes from the Bible. I haven't a clue what they looked like, but at least they spent their skill and they thought the best book to be presented and the best thing to be presented to the nation. And if I have got artistic skill in my fingers and in my spirit and in my mind, what I want is to take the Bible and promote the Bible. How many artists are painting, splash of paint all over the walls everywhere, you couldn't look at it. It's not the Bible now, it's abstract. You hardly get any of them painting scenes. You see why? Because it's completely moved away from what is spiritual to what is secular. There's been a whole shift, and it's the worship of what is material. It's the house you live in. It's the job you work at. It's the career you follow. It's the car you drive. That's the materialism. That's the big system, the image business that Nebuchadnezzar was setting up on the plain of Jura. Material. Of course, it was marked by internationalism. I don't want to go over all of that. But he got everybody there. As I say, there was nobody, no objection. You could be there from every art and part with every opinion that you could think of. Everybody was happily together. They were there from every corner of the empire. Everything was tolerated. And I better stop because the time is marching on. Now, there's an image. Everybody has to bow. Let me just take a second to spread. It'll be important for what I'm going on to. Let me take a second just to speak about this religion. This worship. It's the only thing I have, not the only thing, but one of the things I have against it is a bit boring. Now he sends out a command and he tells them all to come. That's verse 2. It says the princes, those eight men that are all mentioned, it says he told them all to come. You get to verse 3 and it mentions the eight groups again and it says they all came. Just like that. Then you get into verse 4. And it says, at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, the dulcimer, the sackbut, the psaltery, and those six, and at what time ye hear the sound of those, you fall down and bow and worship the image. Verse 5 says, at what time they heard the sound of them, such that they just fell down and did it. So he told them to come. He told them what to do. It wasn't only material, it was very mechanical. There was no room left in this whatsoever for the exercise of the man's spirit. There was no room left in this for any kind of interaction. It was just cold. It was mechanical. It was hard. It never touched the deepest recesses of the human person. It just, you know what it did? All the people that were gathered in that great international gathering, the half of them hadn't a notion what they were doing. All they knew is when this sounds, we have to get down. You know what he did? You know what Nebuchadnezzar did? He turned these human beings into machines. Dear brother, you see that? See where you work? Watch, they don't turn you into a machine. Because Nebuchadnezzar, that's the kind of empire he wanted to build. When I say jump, everybody jumps. When I say fall down and blow my bugle, everybody fall down. And he said, don't have a dissenting voice. And he said, if you dare to lift your head, he says, you'll be in. Well, he said, I'm very nice. I'll do it with music. I'll do it with music. And he said, I want to be very nice to you. It'll be nice. I'll make it easy. And I'll have a lovely atmosphere. But he said, I don't want to force myself or anything. But he says, just in case you would ever think of dissenting, he says, do you see the big bellows of smoke over there? He says, it's all very nice. You see the image, subtly, get people to do it, they don't know they're doing it, and yet always have the threat in the background, if you don't do it, you're finished. That's the system. That's the system. Thank God that in that system. And they worked in it. And they lived in it. And they worked well in it because they had top government posts. There were three men. Praise God for them. Their names are inscribed in eternal significance. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. There were three men. And when tens of thousands of people bowed down to worship the gold, these men said, "We are going to worship God. We are not bowing." So, I leave the image and other things. I want to go to this interview. Called in. It says the Chaldeans accused them. Who were the Chaldeans? The Chaldeans, as we learn from Daniel chapter 2, were the intelligentsia of Babylon. You remember when old Nebuchadnezzar had the dream? Now, just in case anybody gets mixed up here, I used to hear in Sunday school that he forgot his dream. And he had to get the boys to... Poor fellow had his bad memory. He don't you believe it. He never forgot his dream. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't a half-wit like us. He remembered his dream. He said, "Look, boys." He says, "I had a dream last night that annoys me." He says, "You boys tell me what it is and tell me what it means." He knew what it was. But he wanted the meaning because it annoyed him. And he knew that if he wouldn't tell them what it was, if they told him what the dream was, there's a fair chance then they were able to tell him what the meaning was. If he had told them and then they had told him the meaning, sure they could have spun up any yarn. He says, "You tell me what the dream was, and then I'll be prepared to listen to you when you give me the interpretation." Now, he told them, he says, "And if you don't do that," he says, "I'm going to make your houses a dunghill, and you're going to be decapitated." And you men are, these were the wise men called the Chaldeans. And every one of those Chaldeans, their life was on the line. Now, the Chaldeans. And then they told Daniel. Daniel says, "All right." He says, "Don't worry." He says, "There's a God in heaven that reveals secrets. And we know Daniel and these three men prayed and they got the secret." Now these Chaldeans, this is what the point I want to make. These Chaldeans that we are reading about in chapter 3 were the very men that owed their life to the prayers of Daniel and his three friends in chapter 2. If Daniel and his three friends hadn't prayed and got the dream, these men were all dead. They owed their life. And yet you see what they do in chapter 3. When the proper time comes, they accuse the very men to whom they owe their lives. They accuse them before the boss. Can I say to dear brethren here, I don't remember the world knows practically nothing about gratitude. Every man is out for his own pound of flesh. You do a man of the world a favor today, and you say, "Well, now, I helped Johnny, and I really helped him. He was in a very sticky wicket only for me, and I really helped him, and he'll be indebted to me." Listen, if Johnny's a man of the world when tomorrow comes, if he can get one up and put you down, Johnny, do that. Never give him. The last men that should have accused him were the men, and they brought him into this interview. And here we have three men now standing before the mightiest monarch of that particular day and of many other days as well. Now, I can't go through the whole interview. I've already mentioned that there was a good deal of... This is a very interesting thing now, which I mentioned quickly. There was a good deal of intolerance here. "Oh, you say never. Oh, not at all, you say. Sure, you're only after telling us that when this big worship was going on, they had people of every shade. And they had people of every grade. And they had instruments of every kind. And they had nationalities and societies of every mix. And you talked about the internet. This was a very tolerant thing. They had them all there worshipping this golden image of Nebuchadnezzar and bowing down and serving the state. And they were all there tolerated. Aye. But I tell you, do you see, when it come to conviction for God, there was very little tolerance. You know, what amuses me in the world, and I mention it quickly, brothers and sisters, the world in which we live, everybody's talking about toleration. You know, you don't, you have room for everything. You need to have room for everything. And you dare not be prejudiced. And you dare not be biased. And don't dare to say anything about Hindus, or don't dare to say anything about Muslims. I have no problem with that. And they say, we have to be tolerant. And we must be broad in our outlook, and we must be pluralistic in our attitude, and we must give space to everyone. That's the way they talk. I tell you, you try to give out a gospel tract and you'll soon see what space they have. You know, I would love to preach a sermon, and if I'm spared, I think I will soon. And listen, I'm not looking back or anything. No, I'll afflict some other audience with this. The intolerance of tolerance. The intolerance of tolerance. I'm speaking now as a man under British rule. And the British government nowadays would tolerate practically everything but God. You can build a mosque. You can have as many minarets as you want. Because they say, we have to be tolerant. But you say, we're going to put up a gospel text. They say, dare to do it, you're in jail. The intolerance of tolerance. Now that's what these men, where they had everybody there, but just 3 men out of the tens of thousands. 3 men that are going to stand for God, and they can't tolerate them. For all their talk of tolerance. Of course, he interrogates them. He says, now, man, I want to ask you a thing. He says, tell you what I'm going to do. He says, I'm going to give you another chance. He says, we're going to play the organ again, and we're going to play the bugles. And he says, you see, the next time we do it, if you do it, you're all right. He says, no problem. No, sir. You know, let you off. Get off, Andy. I know, maybe you just didn't understand fully what was involved. He talks nice to them, you see, for a while. And he says, you'll get a second chance, for I'm a very tolerant man. He says, you don't, you for the fire. You're for the fire. That's the system. That's the system. Once it comes to God or gold, you have to make a cleavage. Well, these men, I'd like to speak for a minute or two about their spiritual intelligence. You know, they were men of integrity. We talk about conviction. Very calmly, they said, well, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no problem in this at all. They said, you asked us what God is there able to deliver from your hand. How did you notice that? Did you notice that? He didn't say, what God is there who's able to deliver from my God's hand? He says, what God is there who's able to deliver from my hand? You know, he thought he was God. My hand. So here now, the whole thing is shifted. It's not a contest between 3 men. It's a contrast between one big man and the great God of heaven. Now, well, this says, look now, as far as that's concerned, Nebuchadnezzar, our God whom we serve, our God. I didn't take time last evening to mention, you know, in chapter 6, there's 4 times it says, when they're talking about Daniel, they say, his God. In chapter 6, twice, Darius speaks to Daniel and he says, thy God. In chapter 6, once, Daniel says, my God. His God, your God, my God. And in chapter 6, we have one of those great titles of deity, the God of Daniel. And God, these men, they said, our God. We have a relationship with God. A person, our God whom we serve. It's a personal relationship. Our God, it's a practical relationship whom we serve. This is not just talk. And this is not just something theoretical. It comes into our lives. We serve him with commitment. And they said, It's a powerful relationship. Our God whom we serve is able. And he can deliver us, no problem. But he says, he may not. Now this is a very important part of their faith. These men did not believe that God was bound to deliver them. They said, no, he may not. But he said, even he doesn't want to tell you, sir, we are not going to serve your God. He said, our relationship with God is not, it's not mercenary. You know what? There was a young fella, a wee lad, I used to, you know those, I don't know if they still have them, I think they do. You know those sort of, I don't know, was it bubble gum or whatever it was, you put in a penny and you got a bubble gum out or something. You know, some people think God, if you put so much in, I'll go to 3 prayer meetings and I'll get 3 blessings. And if I can put in, God will have to give out. And it's sort of, you put into, you're serving God for what you get. That wasn't the case with these men. They said, if our God delivers us, well and good. But he says, if he doesn't, he's absolutely free. But they said, whether he does or doesn't, whether it works for our good or whether it works for our ill physically, they said, we want to tell you, Nebuchadnezzar, we are not going to bow to your God. It's as stiff as that. Calm, courageous, confident, cautious, and convicted. That's how these men stand. Here's men convicted in their faith, and they're going to stand against the system. You know, it's good to have that kind of conviction, dear brother and sister. And I could mention a number of things that I would be very uncomfortable mentioning. But I would just say this. It's good to have that. You've got a friend that's ill. You say, well now I'm praying that God will put his hand upon my dear Christian friend. You say, I know he can do it. He's able to do it, but it mightn't be his will to do it. And I would love that he would spare the life of this very useful brother or sister who is very dear to me. He can heal, but if he doesn't heal, I'm not going to bow to the God of bitterness. I know Christians, and when God didn't do what they thought he should have done, they became very bitter. Maybe you say, I've taken a stand in my job, I've taken a stand for God, and if I'm made redundant, if I go on well and get the job and keep the job, because I took a stand, but if I'm made redundant, even if it turns out like that, I'm not going to bow to the God of self-pity. If he doesn't, he says, these men say, it makes no difference to our trust in him. Now, I have to leave it there. I could elaborate upon it, brothers and sisters, but mind you, this is absolutely sterling conviction. Now, what about the incinerator? Just 3 quick looks. I want to see them entering the incinerator. Then I want to see them experiencing the furnace. And then I want to take a look at them exiting it. Thank you, Ged. If you want those, I'm not making that up. I make up some of my messages, but I didn't make that part up. It says in verse 21, these men were cast into the furnace. That's them going in. Verse 25, 4 men loose walking in the midst of the fire. That's them right in. Verse number 26, the end of it, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego came forth off the midst of the fire. So that the passage gives us these 3 different movements. You know, it's all right talking, but when it comes to going into the furnace, I think I said last night, and I just remind you of it quickly here, that Daniel's biggest struggle wasn't when he was in the den. The whole victory was won before he went to the den. You see, with these men, when these men were dropping through the lid, where it was like they had an opening at the top here, and then a door down the ground, when these men dropped through the hole, they had, I'm sure, concern. But you know, the biggest part of their struggle was finished. The men that tried to put them in couldn't face it. And the flames scorched the men that were doing it. You know, those who trust God can go through trials that unbelievers could never face. which the Egyptians assigned to do, were drowned. By faith, the believers crossed the Red Sea when the Egyptians prayed. These men of faith, this was what I call asbestos faith. Incombustible confidence in God. When these men went into the flame, the unbelievers that put them in were destroyed. That's them going in. Then I want to see them in the fire. You know, it's really beautiful. The only thing the fire did to these men was burn the vines that Babylon put on them. Their own clothes were never touched. But the cords that Babylon put on, that was the only thing that the fire sundered. And they put the men in bound. But when Nebuchadnezzar peeked in, he saw the men walking free. And there was a fourth one with them. So that when these men were in the fire, they got a freedom they never had before. And they enjoyed fellowship with God that they never knew before. You know, I have talked to Christians, and I'm sorry that I'm hurrying this little part of my message. And they have told me, and I have known some of the fires that they were in. Maybe not all the details. But they said, David, listen. They said, when we were in that trial, it freed us from some of the worldly things that used to bind us. And they say it brought us into a fellowship with the Lord that was sweeter than anything we had experienced in days when things were cooler. It gave them freedom and it gave them fellowship. Another one walking with them, moving in the fire. Fulfillment of Isaiah 43 and so. Then they're coming out. Take a good look at them coming out. You say these men will never be able to work again. You say this whole trial, even though they survived this, they'll never, no. Look at their bodies, there's not a scar. Look at their hair. There's not a singe. Look at their clothes. There's not a scorch mark. Take a sniff, and there's not a smell. These men walk out cleaner than they ever were. Dear brother, dear sister, I don't know. This is forging. This is forging. You've had Nebuchadnezzar's forgery at the start. The big show with nothing. God has men, and when these men step out of this furnace, maybe some of you Christians, I don't know, maybe the furnace is waiting for me. I don't know. The furnace of bereavement, the furnace of redundancy, the furnace of ill health, I don't know. May God give us the confidence, the simple confidence in Him. You know, the will of God never asks a man to go where the grace of God can't sustain him. And the Lord didn't send these men into the fire and say all the best. He went with them. And He walked beside them. And He brought them out unscathed. And I'll not talk about it today, but their influence. They influenced an empire. You know, men who have been through the fire for God and are pure, they'll always have an influence. They influenced the empire of their contemporaries. I think they've influenced us. There have been others who have read this, and they're going to influence men in a day to come. Because there's a very difficult day in this world coming when people are going to be commanded to bow down to an image. And you see, the ones that don't, the Antichrist is going to grind them into the ground with intimidation. And in those days, I think there will be some of those people who will turn back to Daniel chapter 3. And they'll say, if they did it, we can do it. Do you think these men were sorry they stood? Not at all. These men's names have gone down, an example to us all. And I'll have to stop. Dear brothers and sisters, Daniel denied the food. Daniel defied the dam. These men faced the furnace. It's conviction. These are convictions that conquer the world. These are convictions that win the day. These are convictions that transform history and glorify God. Convictions. I dare you. As I stop. Young people, older ones, all of us. I dare you. And I dare myself. Dare for what? I dare us to be Daniel. It won't be easy. May God help us. Because they're needed still. Shall we pray?